Well, last week we started out in Joshua chapter 10, and we covered a lot of the passages, a lot of the chapters here. We went clear up to the end of chapter 12. But in Joshua 10, there at the end, beginning in verse 29, we saw Joshua lead Israel to defeat the southern cities and their associated kings. And the passage we looked at said that this task was completed in response to Yahweh's direction and assurance that he, Yahweh, had delivered these cities into Joshua's hands. Typically, each city was taken quickly, not much time, a day, 2 days, that kind of a thing. There were no survivors, and the kings were destroyed as well. And that theme of Yahweh doing it comes up over and over and over again, making it clear that, yes, Joshua had an army. Yes, it was impressive for the place and the era and the time, at least in terms of the number of men. But even though it was an impressive military, the strength behind what they were doing, the speed at which they were able to travel, and the continued success that they saw day by day was because Yahweh was fighting for them and getting things done on their behalf. Beginning in verse 40 of chapter 10, they give a description of the southern territory that was captured. It included Kadesh Barnea. There is a town, by the way, Kadesh up north, so it's necessary for that to be there. That's down close to Gaza. In that general southern part, there was Goshen, which is between Gaza and Gibeon. And they went as far as Gibeon, and there was the proclamation that the God of Israel, which Yahweh, was fighting himself for Israel. And Joshua and Israel returned as a company to Gilgal. They had made Gilgal their center of operations, and so that's where they continually go back to through this part of the book of Joshua. And then in Joshua 11, we hear about things that happen up north. The king of Hazar hears about the success of Israel in these battles, and this is one of the northern cities. And he's heard about everything from Jericho to their successes in southern Canaan. And so he calls together the kings from all over the north of Israel. It's done by city, by people groups, from the Canaanites to the Hivites. And it's interesting, it's very much the same list as given by Yahweh when he pledges to drive out the inhabitants of Canaan, when he's renewing the promise to Joshua of their success and to the, well, really to the nation of Israel at that point, when they renew the covenant after the great sin of worshiping the golden calf. And so the king of Hazor basically calls all hands on deck. We're going to go fight against Joshua and Israel. And so they're all coming together. And all the kings and armies gather at a place called the Waters of Merom. And it says the soldiers were like the sand on the seashore, so they have a mighty army there. And they're there getting ready and preparing to go after Joshua and his armies. And one of the things that the passage says that they have is many horses and chariots, which were not a part of the army assembled by God, as far as the Joshua and his people were concerned. And at the moment of their assembling up there, and Joshua is still down in their encampment, Yahweh says to Joshua, "Don't be afraid, no fear. Tomorrow at this time, one king will be standing against you." And once again, we reinforce the power and might that's behind the Israeli army. Yahweh says, "I will deliver them all slain before you." And he gives them instructions about the horses and the chariots. He says, "Hamstring their horses and burn their chariots." It's not that they're going to try to compete with them at that level, but they're going to take that out of the future as far as these armies are concerned up there. Now, Joshua and the warriors then march to the waters of Merom, And they're a surprise when they arrive. And yet, even though there's a surprise, the words of the text are, Yahweh delivered them to the armies, to Israel, to Joshua. And so it's not the surprise factor, although God still arranged that as well probably, but it's Yahweh's great power in coming before all of these armies. And the text told us that Israel pursued them as far as the great Sidon, up to the very northern part on the coast. They also went to the east, and they went to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. And it says there were no survivors except a few that went back to their cities and were able to make it to that place. So at that point, Israel's armies turned back from the pursuit. I mean, they've chased them all over northern Israel. And they come together at Hazar, because the king of Hazar apparently was not with the armies. That says in the text that he was the former king of this whole area. And so he was the big leader, and that's why he was able to marshal together all of the peoples and all of the armies of northern Israel and be the leader that would accomplish that. But here he is in his own city. And they captured the city of Hazar, and the king is put to death. And Hazar is burned as a city. They bring it to rubble. And it's the only one in these northern campaigns from all the cities that is burned. They do take from their work in the northern part of Israel spoil in the form of livestock and plunder, but there are no survivors left. And then there's a summary of the leadership as we move down toward the end of chapter 10 that says, Moses was commanded by Yahweh, and afterwards then Joshua was likewise commanded by Yahweh. And there's a statement that said Joshua left nothing undone of what was commanded by Moses. And so these things were commanded to Moses, and then Moses passed it on, so it was commanded by Moses to the entire Israelite nation, and they had seen success. And so in Joshua chapter 11, 16 to 23, we get a summary of the conquest. Verse 18, it says that Joshua waged war a long time. And we know from other things we can put together that was probably about 7 years. And it says throughout all of their conquest, peace was made with no city. They were told to not even offer peace to the bulk of the cities, but to the ones that were on what would become their border or across the border, they were to give them the choice, make peace or be destroyed. And it says that not one of them asked for peace. Of course, we have the Gibeonites that had earlier through deception made peace with Israel. But it says that no city was willing to go for peace, and that a part of that was Yahweh had hardened their hearts so that they would not become soft, but would stay with their original intent to not let Israel overtake them. And it goes on to say that Joshua cut off the Anakim from the hill country, that's down in the south, and cut off their cities down there. And there was no Anakim left in Israel except in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod. Now, we talked about who were the Anakim. That word Anakim means long neck. They were descendants of Anak, and it was become the Philistine area in the future, and these were then likely the ancestors of Goliath, giants in some respect. And after that is done, the land had rest from the war. And so we went over to chapter 12. Our look at chapter 12 was somewhat shorter. We got an accounting of the defeated areas and cities. And it first talks about Moses leading the conquest east of the Jordan against the Amorites, particularly the kings that were at Shion and King Og. And then that area becomes settled and owned by, is given as the inheritance to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh. And we've studied that multiple times. And then the second part of the chapter goes through all the kings and their cities that were taken by Joshua. That's west of the Jordan, and we got a list of 31 cities and kings that were taken by Joshua and his army. So we come to a part here in the book of Joshua where the bulk of the fighting is done. And it's taken about 7, maybe a little more, years to accomplish that. Parts of it went very quickly. The southern conquest was much quicker than the full northern conquest. But that's where we are, which brings us to chapter 13. And I want to start out by looking at the first 7 verses of chapter 13. So I will read those for you. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and very much of the land remains to be possessed. This is the land that remains, all of the region of the Philistines and all of those of the Geshurites, from the Shihor to the east of Egypt, even as far as the border of Ekron to the north. It is counted as Canaanite. The 5 lords of the Philistines, the Gazite, the Ashdodite, the Ashkenalite, the Gittite, the Ekronite, and the Avite, and to the south, and all the land of Canaanite and the Merah belongs to the Sidonians as far as Aphek to the border of the Amorite, and the land of the Gebelite and all of Lebanon toward the east from Baal-Gad below Mount Hermon as far as Lebo-Hamath, all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon as far as Mizrepoth, Maim, and all of the Sidonians, I will drive them out from before the sons of Israel. Only allot it to Israel for an inheritance as I've commanded you. Now therefore apportion this land for an inheritance to the 9 tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh." So Yahweh comes down to Joshua and he tells Joshua, okay, you're now old and advanced in years. And so it's kind of we're at a transition point here. He said, much of the land still remains to be possessed, which gives us a little bit of a problem. If you go back to Joshua 11, verse 23, it says this, "So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war." So somehow we have to understand, well, how in chapter 11 can we say Joshua took the whole land, and then here in chapter 13, God is saying there's still a lot left to do. And so clearly, the bulk of the land has been taken. Israel is the power to be that's exercising dominion in the area. We might say there's still a lot of mop up that needs to be done. And God lists these areas in verses 2-6. Here's where you still have work to do. You've got the Philistines, which is the southwest coast of Israel. All the attention today that you hear about Gaza, it's in that area. You've got the Geshurites, which I handed out a map a little while ago, and you can see up in the northeast, it says Golan. Well, it's the Golan Heights area that we're talking about is where the Geshurites were. They were northeast of the Sea of Galilee. It's up there in the area where there's half a tribe of Manasseh. And so there's a couple of big areas, but he also talks about Shihor, which is east of Egypt. And it talks about being down east of Egypt, south, maybe I should say. They talk more like elevation than direction. But so what is Shihor? Well, it's a river, probably. It's speculation a lot. Could be the Nile. Are they going to go clear down to the Nile and come up to the land of Canaan? There also is a tributary out there that to the Nile, that maybe that's what they're talking about. We just really have lost, frankly, that name about what's it exactly talking about. But it goes to the border of Ekron, which is north of their ways. And then we talk about the 5 lords of the Philistines, which is back in that area of Gaza again. You've got the Gazite, which frankly is where we get that term Gaza. And that area is toward the southern end of Gaza. It's a trade route to Egypt, most probably. Some of these things we've kind of lost track of, but we do the best we can through archaeological evidence and other ways to make good estimations of where we're talking about. The Ashdodites is from the town of Ashdod, and which was a major city, and they were a area known for idolatry. The Ashkelonites are in the city of Ashkelon. That's a coastal area. It's northern part of what you might say where the Philistines were. And the Gittite came from Gath. They're the ones known for giants. They're in the southern part of that Philistinian area. And the Ekronites came from Ekron. And by the way, there is an Ekron on the coast. And I'm sorry, I'm misspeaking. It's near the coast. You can even see it. I don't know if it's on the map I gave you or one of them I looked at. We had some discussion before the class, which was kind of slowing me down a little bit, why I started just a little later, about these places on the maps. Where are they? The town names changed. What's a modern name for those towns? And frankly, some of these things are vague enough as we look back in history. They're kind of hard to nail down specifically. So you get one person's done their research and they've put it one place, and somebody will put it maybe in that same general area but somewhere else. And then in many cases, the cities don't exist anymore. They might be a place that's being excavated. But once you get outside of Israel proper, you've got Arab oversight. The Arabs aren't really excited about people going in and doing excavations where you might be trying to link it up with the Bible. So even that kind of thing is hard. So it's very difficult to be very exacting with all this, but I hunt around and find the best thing that I think I can use in the class, and then for educational purposes, I couldn't copy the whole website or bring it to you, but you can do excerpts, and these maps are excerpts out of other people's stuff, so it's legal and okay, as long as I'm not selling it, which I don't think I've charged you for any yet. But the map I handed out today does have some information that will help us a little bit, but it will also be applicable in the future as we get around to when they establish the cities of refuge that does happen here in the book of Joshua. So when we look at all this, when I say this is where it was, well, at least in general, okay? We might be off a little bit here and there. No, the map I gave you has no city names on it. One of the ones I thought about using, but just really couldn't. I couldn't get it to print clearly enough. And it was very, very busy. But these cities are up that we just talked about. Most of them are on the coast or near the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, pretty much straight west of the Dead Sea area. So if you look at that whole Dead Sea area and just go over to the coast, the cities we're just talked about are pretty much in that area. And it goes on in the last part of that verse, it talks about the Gittites. They're on the South Plains, not right in the Gaza area, but they're a little bit more to the east of that. And then Meraah is near Sidon. Now we're clear up on the very northern side of what Israel would take. Looking at the map we handed out this morning, let me get that pulled out here. When we talk about that Sidon area where you see the big print of Kadesh, Sidon is clear up in that area, and some of these things in around that northern part that we're talking about here for a little bit. So Meraah, and then the town is noted for being a center for Baal worship. So that would be important to them to root that out of the influence on Israel. So the northern part of the Sea of Galilee, bordered with the Amorites. So it covers a pretty broad area because the Amorites, a lot of them are there to the east a ways. And then it mentions all of Lebanon, which would be very much on the northern coast there, even above Sidon. And then it switches and says we've got all the inhabitants of the hill country, which include the Lebanon and the Sidonians, which is hill country to the north. And God says to Joshua, I, Yahweh, will drive them out. And so I'm going to take care of this for you, but follow my command. Allot these places to Israel if I've commanded you. In other words, God is here saying in verse 7, now, therefore, as a result of this command and what I'm going to do, pass out, designate who's going where within these tribes. And it's going to become the responsibility of those tribes to go ahead and clean out what is left to do here west of the Jordan River. And he says it goes to the 9.5 tribes. Well, the eastern part of the Jordan was already allotted, and that comes up here in the next few verses. Questions, comments so far? Okay, let's look at verses 8 through 33, the rest of the chapter. Fairly long section, and we may not make comments about all of it, but there's a few things we'll bring up. It's fairly self-explanatory. So God has just said, allot the 9.5 tribes, their portions, their inheritance within the land of Israel. Probably ought to say a word about inheritance somewhere today. That word inheritance doesn't mean they inherited it necessarily, although God is certainly giving it to them, but it means that that will stay their family group's land throughout the years. And we'll talk about that more before we get done. But it's something that they're going to get to pass down generation to generation to generation to their descendants. Beginning with verse 8 of Joshua 13. With the other half tribe, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses gave them, beyond the Jordan to the east, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave to them. From Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, with the city which is in the middle of the valley, and all the plain of Medeba, as far as Dibon, and all the cities of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, as far as the border of the sons of Ammon, and Gilead, and the territory of the Geshurites and the Maacathites, and all Mount Hermon, and all Bashan, as far as Salcah. All the kingdom of Og in Bashan, who reigned in Asheroth and in Edrei, he alone was left of the remnant of the Rephaim, for Moses struck them and dispossessed them. But the sons of Israel did not dispossess the Geshurites or the Maacathites, for Geshur and Maacath live among Israel until this day. Only to the tribe of Levi he did not give an inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord, the God of Israel, are their inheritance, as he spoke to him. So Moses gave an inheritance to the tribe of the sons of Reuben, according to their families. Their territory was from Aor, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, with the city which is in the middle of the valley, and all the plain by Medeba, Heshbon and all its cities which are on the plain, Dibon, and Bamoth-Baal, and Beth-Baal-Meon, and Jahaz, and Kedemoth, and Methoth, and Kirithaim, and Sibmah, and Zerath-Shaar on the hill of the valley, and Beth-Peor in the slopes of Pisgah, and Beth-Jeshimonoth, even all the cities of the plain, and all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses struck with the chiefs of Midian, Evil, and Rechem, and Zur, and Hur, and Reba, the princes of Sihon, who lived in the land. The sons of Israel also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, the diviner, with the sword among the rest of their slain. The border of the sons of Reuben was the Jordan. This was the inheritance of the sons of Reuben according to their families, the cities, and their villages. Moses also gave an inheritance to the tribe of Gad, to the sons of Gad according to their families. Their territory was Jazer and all the cities of Gilead, and half the land of the sons of Ammon as far as Aor, which is before Rabbath, and from Heshbon as far as Ramoth Mizpah, and Betonim from Mahanaim as far as the border of Debir, and in the valley of Beth Haram, and Beth Nimrah, and Succoth, and Zaphon, and the rest of the kingdom of Sihon, the king of Heshbon, with the border, with Jordan as a border, as far as the lower end of the sea of Chinneroth beyond the Jordan to the east. This is the inheritance of the sons of Gad according to their families, the cities and their villages. Moses also gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh, and it was for the half-tribe of the sons of Manasseh according to their families. Their territory was from Mananaim at Bashan, all the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, and all the towers of Jair, which are in Bashan, 60 cities. Also half of Gilead with Asheroth and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og in Bashan, were the sons of Machir, the sons of Manasseh, for half of the sons of Machir according to their families. These are the territories which Moses apportioned for inheritance in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho to the east. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses did not give an inheritance. The Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, as he has promised to them. A lot of words to talk about what Moses allotted to the half-tribe of Manasseh and to Gad and to Reuben east of the Jordan. Remember, they are there fighting by agreement. And so you can see from the map we handed out today, that northern colored area kind of pink, that's for the half-tribe of Manasseh that's east of the Jordan. And then the kind of pale yellow there is Gad, and at the bottom we have the tribe of Reuben. And all of these towns are listed as a part of their inheritance, and border markers are given just as a review of clarity of what's theirs. And it's more than just they got it, it's that it needs to be recorded here, because this is part, this they can go back to this later on if somebody wants to have an argument about whose it is. Moses, on behalf of God, is right there giving it out and making it a directive about who owns what. And so we get this apportioning done to the 2.5 tribes. Basically, it's the Ammonites. They defeated Sihon and Og in the latter days of Moses, and they took these lands, and these tribes said, hey, this really looks good to us. We'd like to be here. And if you remember the agreement, then they had to go over with their armies and fight with the other 9.5 tribes west of the Jordan. But God did mention that even in doing so, there were some folks that weren't fully dispossessed even here to the east at the time this was written. And so God mentions that and brings it up. And at the time of writing, some of those folks still exist right along with Israel. In verse 14, a point is made. God directs the writer to point out that no land inheritance is given to the Levites. Their inheritance is the offerings by fire to Yahweh. It's their inheritance. In other words, their ministry of being in the priestly function, of doing the priestly servanthood, and for those that are high priests, to be in that role, directly representing Israel to God and God to Israel, that's their inheritance. And you think that's unfair? What do you think about that? Everybody else got a big chunk of ground. Now, you can remember that the Levites in their time are going to get some cities so they can have a place to live and support themselves with regard to their flocks. But they didn't really participate in the fullness of the land apportionment. Nobody's saying anything. God treat them unfairly? Yeah, what do you want to have? Do you want to be the ones that get to directly serve and communicate, some of them communicate with God? Or do you want to have a chunk of dirt? In reality, the greater apportionment, the greater inheritance was to the Levites. And one way we know that is, who's always trying to say, I'm the most important Levite? And who are they saying it about? Was Moses a Levite? Mm-hmm. Aaron was a Levite. And who were they always opposing? Moses. And then later on, it's like, why do you think Aaron's so important? We're just as holy as anybody else. Remember the pans of fire that Moses said, okay, fine, you think you're so wonderful? Make yourself some fire and some incense to burn before God. And these folks did it, and most of them weren't Levites. And God just says, okay, fine. Whew, there, that fire is over, and they're gone. I mean, who were they jealous of? Levites. And even amongst the Levites, they were jealous with each other based on what role they got. But in reality, these people are the favored ones. And so for those of us that live on dirt and go to sleep every night on something built on dirt, and maybe we make our living farming dirt, and maybe we drive on dirt to go to a business that's built on dirt, we think this dirt and owning things like that is so valuable and so important and such a privilege. No, the privilege is knowing God. The pearl of great price was not the dirt. The pearl of great price was found in the dirt. It was buried in the dirt, but it wasn't the dirt. The pearl of great price was Christ himself. And he became our high priest and displaced the Levites. But for the nation of Israel, being a Levite was a favored, honored position. Sometimes it was less honored than others. But it really wasn't unfair. But it gets mentioned. And then it goes on from verse 14, and throughout the passage we describe the portion given to Reuben. And it talks about in verses 21 and 22 how Moses struck the chiefs at Midian. Let's remind ourselves, why did God instruct Moses to strike the people of Midian? Oh, pop quizzes are a great idea. What? It was Midianite women who came up to tempt the Israelite men into immorality. And it wasn't just that Midianite women were so inclined and Israelite men were so easy to tempt. This was a plan, we find out later, given to the kings in the Moabite area as a way to create disfavor toward Israel by Yahweh himself. And so there was a plan here, and God's direction to Moses was to go wipe out the Midianites because of their cooperation in this plan to cause the Israelites to take up sin and incur the wrath of God. And so that's done. What was Balaam's role in this? Why is it mentioned that Balaam was killed too while they were down there? What was Balaam's role in all this? What was Balaam initially asked to do?
To curse him.
And so he's up there with the Moabite kings, and they say, you know, curse him. And what does Balaam do? Huh? He blesses them. And they're not very happy with him for doing that. But he says, hey, I can't say anything that Yahweh doesn't tell me to say. Because he had gone to Yahweh to ask about it. You know, here's this evil man, Balaam. And through part of this, it's hard to discern that he instantly, anyway, intuitively, this is an evil guy. Because he's up there, he's blessing Israel. But this evil man had enough insight to realize, I can't go up there until I know where I stand with Yahweh on all this. And so he goes to Yahweh, and Yahweh says, first he says, don't go. And then the men come back, and God says, well, okay, fine, then go with them. But then there's an argument with the donkey on the way up, if you remember all that. And but before we're done, Balaam is very clearly not going to say anything that Yahweh doesn't tell him to say, and Yahweh keeps telling him to bless Israel. And so eventually the kings get mad at him up in the Moabite area, and they send him back home packing with no reward, which that's what he was doing. He was a soothsayer, if you will, a diviner who would do those things for money. And they basically promised him a house full of gold. But he went home with nothing. But he's the one that said, okay, if you want to get them, do it this way. And entice them into sin. And so it's mentioned here how Moses was sent down with the soldiers to Midian, and they defeated them and struck down Balaam while they were there. Verses 24 through 28 describe the land given then to them by God. That is portion given to one half of Manasseh. But in verse 32, it comes up again. So in this passage, just to kind of remind you, we have seen the apportionment in the words of the passage in detail given to half tribe of Manasseh and Gad and Reuben. But we get back down to verse 32 again, and it says, again to Levi's, got to be mentioned again, no inheritance from Moses, but I really like the words that it finishes out. This time it says, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is their inheritance. They were in a very privileged place. Now, did that mean they owned Yahweh? No, but it meant that relationship with Yahweh as the direct workers for, in this case, the tabernacle, and serving God and doing the ministry functions, as well as they were in the place of being the go-between between God and the people, representing one to the other as needed. And it says that he was their inheritance, meaning they too, like the ones that inherited land areas, what they inherited was this relationship of being the go-between with God and the people would continue to be inherited as well. And so it passed down through lineage. If you're part of the tribe of Levi, you're going to be serving the temple during the years that you should be, or the tabernacle as it starts out to be. And who's going to be high priest? The lineage of Aaron directly. So the ones that were in Aaron's household then would have that as their heritage to pass down through the ages. Questions, comments? All right, let's take a look at Joshua chapter 14. I'm going to start with the first five verses. And this is what it says. Now these are the territories which the sons of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the high priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the households of the tribes of the sons of Israel apportioned to them for an inheritance by the lot of their inheritance, as the Lord commanded through Moses for the nine tribes and the half tribe. For Moses had given the inheritance of the two tribes and the half tribe beyond the Jordan, but he did not give an inheritance to the Levites among them. For the sons of Joseph were two tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and they did not give a portion to the Levites in the land, except cities to live in, with their pasture lands, for their livestock and for their property. Thus the sons of Israel did just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they divided the land. So as we begin chapter 14, there's no division of the land done yet. And so we get in these verses the introduction of how it's going to happen. And it's mentioned right out of the box that the territories apportioned in Canaan that we're talking about are west of the Jordan, and it's going to go to the nine and a half tribes, where the half tribe is Manasseh plus the other nine that don't yet have an inheritance. And who is leading this effort? Who's there while this is being done? There in verse 1. You've got Eleazar, the high priest. Who else?
Joshua.
And
the heads of the tribes.
So we've got the leadership all put together there while this is going to happen. Verse 2 reminds us of how it is directed by God to happen. And how is it directed by God to be done? By Lot. We still don't know exactly what that was. It was something to do with, we might call it chance, but it's certainly not chance because God is directing. But it's the kinds of things we associate with chance in our world today. Rolling dice is chance. Well, using the lot was a thing where there was an activity done, and based on what came up, so to speak, what was displayed, let God make decisions about who would do what. What's a recent example of the use of lots that we've seen in our study here in the last number of weeks? Book of Joshua, where are lots used? You remember? Clear back in the conquest of Jericho. Now look, I'm the old one in the class. I'm the one that can't remember. Remember? What went wrong when they went up to the next conquest at Ai? How did that go for them?
The guy that took plunder.
Yeah, they got run back. They got beaten up by this little community of Ai. Why? Because Achan had stolen things from the conquest of Jericho, and that was don't do it. And even before it happened, they said, if anybody does this, it's going to put all of Israel under a curse. And so how did they figure out, how did they find out, how did they do their investigation to determine who did this? They used lots. And they started out, Joshua was there administering it, and they started out figuring out which tribe it was in. They determined the tribe, and then they went through the households and down through the lineages until it came up to Achan. And an interesting thing about it, well, there was no question when they got to Achan in terms of, did this really work? Do we really know who did this? No, Joshua looks at Achan and said, don't shame yourself now. Honor God by telling the truth. Glorify God in revealing what you've done. And Achan does it. So how well do lots work? Do they work pretty well? It's probably a good thing we don't know what the physical activity of lots was. Because if we did, we'd probably be out trying to use it. People would make all kinds of a mess out of that. I can even imagine a TV mystery show where they're using lots. Of course, it might be a pretty short show. But nonetheless, we'd make a mess of that. We would glorify the wrong thing. It's just as it's a good thing that Moses' body isn't buried in a place that we know where it is. It would be such a shrine that's unbelievable. They'd be worshiping Moses, and that's not what Moses would have wanted. It's not what God wanted. But lots worked. God was in control of those lots. And so who's really apportioning the land here? God himself. And God says, use the lots. In other words, God says, I'm going to apportion this land and where it goes. And we have the right people there so that if there's a dispute later, you've got Joshua, you've got the high priest, Eleazar, and you've got all the leaders of the tribe could be right there together saying, no, don't forget, this is what came up, this is what you got, this is where you go. And it's going to be an inheritance for you. Does that mean they can never sell it or anything? You remember this? Actually, it's at the time of Jubilee is when it goes back. Well, it might go back at 7, too. I'd have to go back and look. See, I told you I'm the one with the bad memory here. I know it, at the year of Jubilee, it goes back to the original owners, the original family. So, you know, if you bought the land, you're really not buying it. At best, it's a long-term lease. And so that has to be accounted for when it's being done. And so we do it by lot. God is doing it. We've got all the leadership there. And then verses 3 through 5, we go over the fact that the tribes east of the Jordan have already received their inheritance from Moses, the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh. And we get to mention that Joseph really gets two tribes. He's got Manasseh and Ephraim. Now, why would Joseph get two tribes? Joseph became the one that got the firstborn privileges as Jacob's life is ending. And so he gets a double portion. The firstborn gets a double portion of the inheritance. So he gets a double portion here. And it's done by allotting to the half, to the Manasseh tribe and to the Ephraim tribe. And so in verse 5 we see that the sons of Israel did as Yahweh commanded through Moses. And so now let's look at verses 6 through 15. And it says, all the inhabitants, verses 6 through 15. Turn two pages. I was in the right spot. Then the sons of Judah drew near to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, you know the word which the Lord spoke to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, a servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. I brought word back to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt with fear, but I followed the Lord my God fully. So Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land on which your foot has trodden will be an inheritance to you and to your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God fully. Now behold, the Lord has let me live, just as he spoke, these 45 years. From the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses when Israel walked in the wilderness, and now behold, I am 85 years old today. I am still as strong today as I was in the day of Moses, the day Moses sent me, as my strength was then, so my strength is now, for war and for going out and coming in. Now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day, for you heard on that day that Anakim were there, with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. So Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and for an inheritance. Therefore Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, until this day, because he followed the Lord of God of Israel fully. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, for Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. So the sons of Judah come up first. They're the ones who are going to get an apportionment first. And they come up, they're at Gilgal, that's still their headquarters. And as they come up, Caleb directs his attention to Joshua and says to him, you know what God said about you and me to Moses in Kadesh Barnea. And in verses 7 and 8, Caleb reviews the events. I was 40 years old. Moses sent me out as a spy. There were 11 others as well. And I brought back what was in my heart. What does that mean, in his heart?
Side, the truth.
Truth? What he really believed? It was not something that he was making up or trying to say. He didn't try to figure out what Moses wanted to hear. He told him what was really in his heart. And he says, but my fellow spies made the people melt with fear, but I followed Yahweh my God fully. What did he mean by that?
He looked at it through God's promise.
And as a result, Moses swore on that day, made an oath that the land you have walked on will be yours. Go back to Numbers chapter 14, verse 24. This is in the middle of all that encounter as the spies came back. Numbers 14, 24. And Numbers 14, 24 says, "But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it." That's more than just Caleb will enter the promised land. As Moses passed this information on to the people, that's what Caleb said, that Moses swore that God had said, it's going to belong to Caleb, this part of the land that he had entered. And what he's primarily talking about when he's sharing his heart is, yeah, they're big people. Yeah, they're mighty. But God will give it to us. That's what Caleb believed. That's what he said. And he tried to turn the people to understand. Now, why is he addressing all this to Joshua in particular? There's more than one reason. What's one reason? What's that?
The land.
Well, the land is being apportioned. But why Joshua in particular? Why else? Joshua's not just leading this day, which is part of it. He's the head, so he's going to say, hey, I'm appealing to the head. But Joshua was there with him. How many other people that are there that day were there with him? I mean, all of those that were adults are gone. There might be some that grew up as children that are there with him, but they wouldn't have been a part of that meeting probably. And so this is something that he and Joshua shared together. Now, I should have brought Kleenexes for some of us on this next statement. The next couple of verses. The Lord let me live. It's 45 years later. I'm now 85 years old, but I'm as strong today as the day Moses sent me. So those of us that make us want to cry when we think about being 85 years old and doing as good as when we were 40, I'm sorry I didn't bring any Kleenexes. But he says, I've been a warrior all this time. I'm still an able warrior. Give me the hill country. The Anakim are there, and he starts talking about things directed from God, and there's two directions from God that are a part of this passage here. One direction goes back to the day when God directed that Caleb would get the land, but the other direction is we've just finished where God has said, you still have the Anakim here. And so he says, give me the hill country. Yes, there's Anakim there. They have fortified cities, but if Yahweh is with me, I will drive them out. So he's not just asking for the land. He's not saying, go give me the land. Now you guys clear it out and then I'll go settle. Give me the land. I'll take the responsibility for leading the war effort to drive out these people from their cities. And what did Joshua do? Joshua blessed him. How? Well, doesn't say. We can surmise it was probably words of affirmation. It was probably blessings on getting the job done. Probably praising him for continuing to trust in the Lord faithfully all through these years. And certainly he's wishing that Yahweh's blessings will flow to him. And that's what Caleb himself has asked for. And so as a result, they gave Hebron to Caleb as an inheritance. And it was still in the family of Caleb at the time of the writing of the book. It talks about a name change. It used to be called Kiriath Arba, which was an honorary name to Arba because he was the greatest of the Anakim. And it became Hebron. And Hebron means association. And I think it's referencing the association between God and Caleb. Hebron's about 19 to 20 miles south of Jerusalem, 13 to 14 miles southwest of Bethlehem. It's the highest city in Israel, at least the borders of that of the time that Israel was at its fullest. It's got a 3,000-foot altitude. And it's interesting that when Abraham parted with Lot, where did Abraham go? Hebron. And what happened at Hebron? If we're not going to take the time because we don't have it, you could look at Genesis 13, 14 through 17. It's at Hebron that God makes the first promise to Abraham, look around, walk the land, you get all the land. Whatever you see, wherever you walk, it's going to be yours. David moved his capital here after Saul was defeated or gone, and before they took Jerusalem. So it was even the capital for a while. It's near Hebron that we have the Oaks of Mamre, which is the burial site for Sarah, her sons, and so her son, and then other descendants, and so on. Lots of Old Testament events at Hebron. And, you know, one of the things that is a part of this is the clear, consistent promise of God. They're now apportioning the land. It's been centuries since the promise was made. They were about 400 years in Egypt. They've got about 45 years plus traveling around. They've got several generations from Abraham to Jacob, 550, 600 years. And yet God's promise on this day is being fully fulfilled. I don't know how much that was on their mind, but it ought to be on ours. Because you can continue to look at promises. One of the other great promises to Abraham was, it's through your seed that all the nations of the earth will be blessed, referring to Christ. And there are still more promises coming, including the time that those who are faithful to Christ are glorified. We ought to be looking for promises just as much as they were. All right, I stole a couple, 3 minutes from you, but thank you.